session number 27341, Reel 3.
John Maybank, Reel 3.
Yeah, well, we finished at Sealand in June, I think it was June 1943, and then we went. We were sent up to Morecambe to wait for a ship, and that's where I just can't remember the actual date, but we were. It was sometime after the 19th of July, and the history will tell us that it was, I think it was late July, when I boarded the Queen Mary with our team, those pilots who were going with her, and we were given the task of looking after Winston Churchill and the War Office members who were on board the Queen Mary, going to the Ottawa Conference. They had a big conference. I think the President of the United States was there. And we had Guy Gibson on board and various other heroes. The chap who was the Chinditz man, what was his name, Wingate, and various other people and their girlfriends or wives. And Mary Churchill was with Winston. And we had to look after Winston's gang. And the only thing I can recall about it with any clarity is all the bottles of whiskey and gin and brandy that were thrown over the side in the mornings. Drunken bums they were. But and then he came and thanked us at the end and shook hands with us all. And we were all paraded on our little hang in a little area on a deck. And he walked around and shook hands and said, you know, what a good job we'd done. Oh, dear. Actually, all our job was is to keep nosy Parkers away, you know, and give them privacy. And it was a jolly good voyage. We enjoyed it immensely. And then we were running up the gangway. There was a little ladder up onto the top deck. One of our numbers was a chap called Jim Carney, who later died. I think he committed suicide. But he'd been an actor. And as he ran up the stairs, he was patting the bottom of this army girl who was walking up behind him, in front of him. And when he got up the top, he realized it was Mary Churchill, Winston's daughter. So here was this leading airman banging away at a junior commander's backside. But he was such a good-looking lad that she couldn't resist it. He was a charming man, he was. Right, but 6'4". He was a bit older than us. He was about 27, 28, something of that age. But I think his wife left him post-war, and he didn't like that. I think he committed suicide. I don't know how he did it, but he was a nice lad. And we had several other sort of characters. We had a fellow called Julian Mond, who later became Lord Melchett. He was of the Mond family, the Brunner Mond, the ICI. And Julian became the head of British Steel. And he did that job, and then he died quite suddenly in his 40s. I only met him once after the war. We'd had a long chat in an aeroplane, but coming back from Holland. Anyway, we went to Canada, and we didn't start flying there immediately. It wasn't until September that we took up flying. We had to wait because there was a bit of a bottleneck. My main instructor was that chap, J.S. Ford, F-F-O-R-D-E. He was a sergeant, a flight sergeant he was, and he was my principal instructor. And he later became secretary to the Bank of England and signed all the checks. All the banknotes. His signature was on the banknotes. It was quite remarkable. So that's John Ford. And you'll notice in my logbook, there's an awful lot of Fords there. And the flying took the same form that it had with tiger moths. A lot more of it. And, of course, we were flying Harvards. And the Harvard was a marvellous aeroplane. It was so... manoeuvrable, and it was quite a powerful engine, a noisy engine, but very powerful, ready for its size, and you could do anything in it, really anything. It was most a delight to fly, and you soon got into the hang of it, and if you didn't, well, you got thrown away because it was such an easy aeroplane.
How did it contrast with the Tiger Moth? What were the main differences?
Oh, well, it was much heavier. Tiger Moth's a very tiny, light aeroplane. The Harvard is a much bigger, heavier, all-metal structure. And it was really quite an advanced training aeroplane. You could do anything in it. You could do bombing runs, you could do machine gun firing, it had machine guns. And it was just... A very fine training aircraft. In fact, I don't suppose they've ever had a better one, even today, for that sort of work.
Did it have any vices at all? Did it have any vices that you remember?
I don't recall any vices. There were no vices that I can... I had one prang. I was told to go up very high, at least above 10,000 feet, and to glide down and make a forced landing over a forced landing airfield at Picton, Ontario, which was a few miles, 30 or 40 miles away from the main Kingston airfield, and where we were actually doing our training. Incidentally, Kingston was known as the 31 standard as SFTS, and it's a flying training school, and I think we were the 90th course, and on this particular there were probably three courses being trained at Kingston. It was a very large airfield. Anyway, this day I went off and I did this, got up to 10,000 feet, and they said shut the throttle and glide down, don't forget to open the throttle every so often just to keep the temperature in the engine high, otherwise it might freeze up. I forgot about that. And I came down and I couldn't get the engine to start. Try as I might, it just wouldn't start. The whirl around but wouldn't start because the carburetor had frozen, you see, so the petrol wasn't getting through. And I was just a bit too high. Because you normally don't land, you open the throttle and off you go again. I thought I had blipped the engine, but if I did, it was too high when I did it. Anyway, I had to land in a field filled with boulders. Unbelievable. Some of them were as high as sort of 3 or 4 feet. And they'd obviously cleared the flying field and chucked all the boulders and then built a fence around the flying field. Well, I found myself going over this fence at about 20 feet and looking down and just seeing boulders. I thought, oh, but I saw a little a little valley in between, and I just pushed the stick forward and landed there, wheels up. I got my wheels up, thank God. And I finished hard up against a boulder about as high as that, with the wing out up against it on one side, and other boulders on the other side. And I never harmed that aeroplane. It wasn't damaged. And they sent poor old Julian Mond, who I mentioned earlier, over to look after it. And the instructor, chief flying instructor, came over and flew me back and made me fly back, actually, and left Julian in charge, you see. Well, they forgot about Julian. Anyway, on the way back, I had to do aerobatics and things to get my nerve back. I hadn't lost my nerve. I was shaky like a leaf, but when I'd had a cigarette and sort of settled down, I felt pretty good. I thought, well, I've saved the aeroplane. Anyway, Julian had to go there, and they forgot about him, and he stayed all night, poor lad. And they went for him next day, and he was pissed off. Anyway, there we go.
So with the Harvard, you mentioned with the Harvard it's a much more advanced sort of trainer. How did the cockpit look? Because you described the Tiger Moth to me as being quite a simple cockpit.
Was the cockpit was quite a complicated piece. There was hundreds of switches and it had light switches and landing lights and things like that, and wing lights. And you had a more it was a modern fighter cockpit, really, with. Well, it had the four main sort of oil airspeed altimeter, turn and bank indicators, but these were all rather better quality and more up to date than the Tiger Moth, which was probably all 30s stuff. You had an undercarriage lever, you see, and you had flap levers. Well, you never had all those things. You had a little rod thing in a Tiger Moth, so. You had all the appurtenances of a modern aircraft I don't think it was a variable pitch propeller, or was it? I can't remember now. But if it was variable, it was variable pitch, yes. In which case you had your pitch lever. You see, you had to learn all these new things about engines.
Were you given a time to familiarise yourself with the cockpit?
Oh, yes. But you see, you didn't fly that machine. It was without an instructor to start with. So you had familiarization whilst you were flying with the instructor. And that was the most important bit, because he was telling you things and you were using all the instruments. And he would say, right, see that instrument over there? Right, that's your starter thing, you see. And he'd show you what to do. And so consequently, you learned almost by rote. By actually doing the various necessary manoeuvres and switches and things to make the aeroplane work. And it was a delightful aeroplane, and I loved it. I really did. I sort of seemed to come into my own flying the little Harvard, and I got an above average, was the only time I ever did, above average for pilot navigator, for pupil pilot, for air gunnery, and has a special aptitude as a pilot navigator.
Can I ask you about the undercarriage? Did that cause any problems, coming from a non-retractable undercarriage to a retractable one?
None at all. No, it was a very easy undercarriage. It was mechanical. It did it itself, hydraulics, and it dropped down very quickly and easily. Unlike some other aircraft, which you had to wind down. So it was just a jolly good aeroplane, and I did a couple of hundred hours, I think, in the Harvard.
Well, you mentioned air gunnery as well.
Yeah.
How did you practice the air gunnery? Because that would have been something new, wouldn't it? On this.
Yes. Well, we had bombing range. And nearby there were targets, which we could use to fire against. We didn't do a hell of a lot of air firing, although I'm just trying to see how many occasions I've got down here. But in memory, I didn't think I did enough, anything like enough. And certainly bombing was most... And I don't think the instructors were very good at it, actually. They weren't very good at teaching us how to bomb with a Harvard. I don't think any of them had ever done any bombing in real practice, because they were all, most of them had only just finished flying school themselves, and because they were so good, they'd been kept on as instructors.
So with the air gunnery, were you practicing against drogues, or was it ground targets?
Ground targets. We did an awful lot of aerial mock combat, which was with instructors and on our own. Hairy stuff that was.
Was that encouraged?
It was encouraged, yes. Yes. I'm just trying to see if there was anything here about it. Yes, there was FXADP six attacks. I don't know what that was. FX-ADP. But I think they were all to do with aerial combat.
Would the Harvard have had a camera on board?
Yes.
While you were doing that to record what you were doing?
No. Yes, I've got a huge reel of film from Harvard. I think it was Harvard. Aerial. And I certainly did it in... But, you know, memory's terribly vague on these things. I can't remember whether it was a Harvard camera or whether it was the Wildcat camera at Yeovilton. No, but I think it was at Harvard we had cameras.
At this stage, is there any element of you being selected for what role you would eventually take? Or are you being assessed at
this point? We were never told how we were assessed or for what role we were assessed, what aircraft or future. It wasn't in the hands of the RAF, although they may have made recommendations on writing about what this guy was like, steady pilot, you know, make him a bomber pilot or torpedo bomber pilot or a fighter pilot. I suppose they must have done.
Is it a silly question to ask what you hope to be?
Well, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. But it's quite incredible. I had no idea that I was going to be one, and I could have been anything, really. But I finished up as a fighter pilot. I'll never forget, a Corsair appeared one day at one of the hangars at Kingston, and we were shown this aircraft just to have a look at it. And I thought, and I said to somebody, well, I have to God, I never go near that brute. What a monstrous aeroplane. God, we'd never seen anything like it in our lives before. It was such an evil looking aeroplane. And of course, that's the one I finished up on. This is the way life is, isn't it? Ah, dear. Anyway, that was really the whole situation in Canada was to bring us to a level of flying. A competence that we would be okay in the more modern fighter. It was to simulate a modern fighting aeroplane.
Can I just ask something about the markings of the Harvard? What kind of markings and colours?
Well, they're an all yellow aeroplane to start with, and they had large numbers on the sides, and they had the roundels above and below the wings. But other than that, it was just a big yellow blob in the sky.
Were you able to do any low flying?
We did an awful lot of low flying, yes, we did. And cross-country night flying. We did a lot of low flying, night flying. A hell of a lot of aerobatics. And formation flying, too.
Well, that was interesting. What type of formation flying did you do?
In VIC formation and squadron formation in series of VICs. You know, we'd get sort of 12 aeroplanes in the sky and three or four series of things. They never practiced any modern fighting tactics. It was all close formation flying. And I think probably correctly so, because you had to learn to fly in close formations, because in cloud flying you had to be tucked right in, you know. And we did a lot of cloud flying in the Navy. The sea very often had a lot of cloud over it. And so that was excellent. I mean, you learnt the discipline of keeping your eye and therefore your aircraft completely at one with the next aeroplane to you, whether you're a number two or a number three or a number four. You were tucked right into the wing route, if you could, you know. It was pretty hairy stuff. And we sort of prided ourselves on how close we could get, you know.
What distances will we be talking about?
Oh, 2 or 3 feet. Yes, 2 or 3 feet. But not to begin with. God, 30 feet. Get in. Go on, tuck it in, you know. And so you had this constant badgering to get closer. There were no mid-air collisions when... Although goodness knows, I don't know why not at times, because some of these pilots were very raw. But the old instructor, we did a lot of formation flying on our own, in twos and threes. But anything larger than that, we had instructors with us in the main.
And what about the low flying? What's the sensation of low flying as opposed to sort of flying at a certain...
Yes, well, that I do recall. We used to go over the bombing range and there were some marshes. We were in on the edges of Lake Victoria, Lake Ontario. And, of course, there's a lot of low-lying land around. And so we'd fly very close to the ground, and they liked us to get right down, you know, so you were sort of skimming over the bulrushes, as it were. And it was great fun, but I didn't like being too close to the ground. I thought, it scared the pants off me at times. This instructor, John Ford, he said to me one day, right, I'll give you a thrill. So he turned himself upside down and flew close to the ground upside down. And then he went up like that and rolled over as we came up. And I can tell you, I was looking at the ground and I was absolutely pooing myself. I was really, really frightened. But he said, now, it's all right. You've just got to keep the pressure on the stick. He said, if you think you're going to pull back, he said, that's when you hit the ground. He said, keep the pressure on the stick. And he taught me that. And really, it wasn't as difficult as it seemed, but I didn't do it. I didn't get right down low. I used to do a lot of inverted flying, but up a bit.
And at low-level flying, do speeds become much more obvious?
Yes, it does. It's a hugely exciting business to fly low. And we did a lot of it in the Navy because we had, in the training, because we had to learn to fly over the sea at low levels. And so, you know, the training had to incorporate an element of this, and quite a large element, at later stages rather than at higher in Canada. In Canada, we did a bit. In fact, I can see here low flying in formation. That used to be a bit hairy because... If you were the last aircraft, or the lowest aircraft when you were turning to starboard, or the lowest aircraft when you were turning to port, you were looking down at the ground more than... I tell you.
And you must have been introduced to radio communication for the first time as well.
Yes. We were in radio communications on the Harvard all the time. We had to call up to get permission to take off. So you started to learn your cockpit drill, including talking to the control. What do you call it? The control
tower.
Tower. Tower. That's right. The control tower. Yes, and you'd call up now permission to take off and permission to pancake. Always you were. Seeking permission to do something or other when you were coming in to land or to take off. You had to, because otherwise it wasn't safe. There were too many aircraft in the air not to be in touch. I mean, it was common practice, but we didn't know that until we had to do it. And we soon learned why. And we did a lot of night flying there too. We went, there was a place called Gananoque, which was a few miles away. Yes, where they had it ahead of the runway, and they had night flying there, and we had to do be in charge of that airfield as well. So we were armed with a red and green lamp, so we could flash okay to land to the next boat coming down, and flash him in red if he was coming in. And one of my pals, a bloke called Peter Scott. Lives on Jersey. He came in one night and I was flashing red because his undercarriage was up. He just ignored the red light and came and landed on his belly with a big pile of sparks came up in there. It was incredibly exciting. Yes, so that was most exciting. But he said, I never saw you. I said, well, you were supposed to be looking.
Was the idea there that you're actually taking some control and you're getting another kind of perspective on how to...
I think that was the whole idea, because you certainly did get to see what the problem might be in landing. We didn't ever have to do, we had to do ADLs, that's a dummy deck landings, but only just one or two occasionally to see what it was like. But it wasn't until we went to flying school, that we, to the Naval Flying School, that we did. We did a lot of that.
What does that entail, doing
dummy deck landings? Well, you have an instructor at the end of the runway with some bats, and he has a series of bat positions. These are two, like two big, not tennis rackets, a bit smaller
table
than that.
Table tennis.
Table tennis, a bit bigger than a table tennis racket. And he had to, he would hold his arms up in various positions to tell you where you were. If he held his arms up like above his head, you were too high. Then he'd say, come down, and he'd wave his arms. And if you were level flying, he'd keep his arms straight out so you knew you were coming in at the right angle. And if he wanted to drop you down, he would drop you down a bit by dropping. It was all seemingly natural. We didn't have a lot to learn. It was very easy to know what the bats meant. And if he wanted to wave you off, he'd just wave them around his head, you see, and off you went around again.
Was the airfield marked off for a deck area?
Yes, they had white lines. And the batsman would stand to on the port side, if you like, the left-hand side of the aerodrome, and you came in, and you had to make a big low-level approach at an angle to get the hook down so that the hook would catch a wire. Well, of course, most of the aircraft we were flying had hooks, and you were supposed to drop them, but they didn't make you drop them on ordinary land because, of course, they would just probably break. So you didn't bother with that, and you just landed with tail down, really. That was the whole idea. A three-point landings were what you had to do, which was tail down to tail back. And if it was a bit too far down, it didn't matter, because the hook would catch a wire and pull you down anyway. But that was, Canada was all to do with the Harvard. And nothing else.
Did you receive your wings at the end of Canada?
Yes, on 14th of January 1944, I got a certificate entitled to FAA wings with effect from 14th of January. In actual fact, I think from Christmas onwards, we'd finished at Christmas, but the wings ceremony was on that day, and so.
Had you had a final examination, flying examination?
Yes, yes, yes. I think I came bottom of the written examination and top of the flying. Ah, oh dear, it was very funny. But if you look through the logbook, you'll see the incredible amount of different activities one did on a Harvard. There's bombing, low-level flying.
What was the anti-sub DC-8?
Anti-submarine. It's 20. I don't know. I can't remember. But I failed all of them, and yet they gave me overall above average, so they must... Oh, no, I got some medium-high high-dive bombing. I got passes in that. Anti-submarine DCA, or whatever DCA meant, average 22 pass, average 22 pass.
Because it sounds very much at this stage that they're trying to get all-round pilots who have a number of abilities.
Yes. You had to do all the sort of flying you ever would do in any aeroplane you did in this Harvard. The only thing you didn't do was deck landings, because you couldn't. It wasn't equipped for that purpose.
And it might seem a silly question again, but how did you feel having obtained your wings in January 4th?
I felt very good. Very good indeed. It was a thrill, and of course they sent us off on leave, and we all went down to America, and whooped it up in New York and had great fun. But in fact, we went first of all to New York State, to a little town called Watertown. And there was a tour of us went ahead and bought a lot of booze, because you could buy it. They couldn't buy booze in Canada during the war unless you were over 21, and then you had to have a license, god damn it. So we went down and bought a lot of booze and took it into a hotel, and when the mob arrived, of course we were already well started, and everybody got plastered that night. Marvellous fun.